Audi.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients, like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Mark Abraham, OBE, aka Mark the Vet, was inspired by his Holocaust survivor grandmother to change UK law and dramatically improve how we treat our pets. He's vaccinated dogs in the Mumbai slums, rescued vodka-fueled dancing bears in Ukraine, operated in Buddhist temples in post-tsunami Thailand, battled dog meat farms in South Korea, travelled deep into the Amazon jungle, and even rehabilitated prisoners with pit bulls in US prisons. All this and more with Mark Abraham on the Big Travel Podcast.
Mark, thank you for the donuts. That's really exciting. Nobody has ever brought me donuts before.
Well, it's just a nice thing to do, isn't it? When you go to someone's house, you bring a gift.
Yes, messy as my house is.
And they were vegan donuts.
They were vegan donuts. Did you think I was a vegan?
No, but I just thought, you know, vegan, animal welfare, yeah. Ties in.
Yeah, it does. But you're not a vegan.
Plant-based. Yeah, I'm plant-based.
Are you plant-based?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, this is a really interesting thing because I know a lot of people who are passionate about animals. And to be honest, I'm growing to like animals, but I can give and take them a little bit. But I know a lot of people are very passionate about animals who are also very passionate about eating a lot of animals.
Yeah, it's confusing. And then you'll get the argument that, well, as long as they have a great life and as long as they're, you know, locally sourced, organic. And then you think, if you like animals that much, A, why are you complicit in killing them when they're having the best time? And B, you're still supporting violence towards animals. So you can't like them that much.
But everyone draws the line somewhere, don't they?
Well, there's no line to be drawn. Either you support violence against animals or you don't.
Is all animal killing for food all violent?
Well, if you can find a situation of food that's eaten every day by most people that we know that eat animals that isn't, then let me know. But, you know, when you see abattoirs and what goes on behind the scenes, it's all pretty violent. But people are paying for that, they're complicit in that, and with so many alternatives out there, I mean, especially in Brighton and Hove, it's ridiculous. There's really no excuse why people shouldn't be more plant-based, at least. I'm guilty. I only turned plant-based sort of 5-6 years ago, and I'm a vet. I don't try and make people not eat animals, but I just suggest there are alternatives that are worth a try. And usually when you plant that idea in people's minds, it's just a matter of time till they start becoming a bit more, let's say, flexitarian than demanding or needing meat every meal.
It's interesting that you use plant-based rather than vegan. Is that because, like, vegans have had negative connotations put on them?
I find vegan quite a trigger for people. People get quite almost offended by it.
They do. Why is that?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know, and it's a shame. And I always say plant-based because I think it's more accurate, weirdly, in terms of description, and it seems to be less inflammatory.
Back to the subject about everyone drawing the line somewhere. You know, people would eat, you know, cow but not horse, or eat horse but not a golden retriever, which sounds funny, but actually people do eat golden retrievers or dogs like that. I was really surprised when you look at the dog meat trade. We'll go on to this because I know it's something you worked with, but we'll go against, I should say.
Yeah.
I'm a vegan, except dogs. Yeah. I'm all right with a bit of dog meat. You know, draw the line somewhere. But when you see like the dog trade, you think it's going to be some special type of breed of dog, but it's actually the dogs that we call pets?
Well, it depends on which country that the dogs are being eaten in. Because some, say, for example, Korea, you have dogs that are specifically bred to be eaten.
Uh-huh.
And in other countries, you'll have dogs that are stolen to be eaten. So there is a difference there. But as you say, my dear, dear friend Peter Egan, who some of you may know from, who's an actor and an animal welfare campaigner, his phrase selective compassion describes exactly what you've explained, which is we have dogs that are animals as pets that we love and are family members, and then we go and eat a cow. So it really doesn't make sense, doesn't take much stripping back or drilling down to understand that these are all sentient animals that all have feelings and of pain and fun and families as well. And sort of we pick and choose who gets murdered and who doesn't.
Oh,
and it's brutal.
Yeah,
really.
No, it is brutal. And like many people, you know, I sort of close my mind to it half the time. I mean, not eating meat is one thing, but I do eat dairy, and I know that the dairy is like a hideous industry, you know, in many ways. And, you know, I close my mind to it because
people
I can't
do.
Bear to think about
people
it.
People compartmentalise. We've been conditioned for years about what's acceptable, what's appropriate, what isn't. As you say, France eat horse quite normally. We don't eat horse. Some cultures eat dogs, as we've discussed. In India, the cow is sacred. But at the end of the day, you either support violence against animals or you don't. And I'm very proud that I don't.
And I can imagine, I mean, we'll shut up about it because some people are going to start hating us. But
yeah. They'll be turning off about me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But please don't.
But I'm not a vegan. You know, I do have, and actually, I confess, I also eat fish as well. So that's probably even worse. But, you know, it must dawn on you when you're a vet and you're saving animals and then eating them. It's like really odd. Like you're rescuing somebody's pet cat one day and then going home and having a steak.
Yeah, it seems a bit disingenuous when you put it like that. And that's because it is.
Yeah, what do you think other vets are doing? Do you know many other vets that have gone plant-based?
I know a few, and I know a few vet nurses that have, and it just surprises me how many haven't, and again, how long it took me personally. But yeah, all we can do is just keep spreading the word and not forcing people to do it, but just empowering people with the decision they have to make, which is, do I support violence against animals or don't I? And it's quite easy if you're an animal lover not to.
Really interesting. That wasn't where I wanted to start.
No.
And it was a really interesting point that I'm glad we actually managed to pick up. The other thing you brought, apart from vegan donuts, is your OBE.
I thought I'd bring it to show you. As we started this chat, didn't we, when I was about to get it. So I thought I'd bring it actually to our little chat.
From visiting the... I was going to say the Queen. It wasn't. It was Prince Charles.
It was Prince Charles at Windsor Castle, yeah, in early March. And it was definitely one of the most surreal, most special, unforgettable days of my life.
So that's an OBE for services for animal welfare.
Yeah, services for animal welfare, yeah.
Amazing. So how was the experience?
It's unbelievable. Took my mum. We were only allowed to take one person because of COVID. Took my mum, and you sort of go through all the different rooms in Windsor Castle, and then you finally reach this. I mean, all the rooms are stunning, obviously. And then the final room is beautiful, and they brief you about how to meet him and what you say and how the conversation works. And you bow, and then you go into this most incredible room, and there's like a string quartet in the corner playing sort of modern pop songs, but in this unbelievable room. And then you walk up to Prince Charles, and you have two steps, and then you bow and two steps forward, and then you have a chat for about 3 to 4 minutes, and then he shakes your hand, and then you step back 2 paces, and then off you go.
And what did you say to him?
Well, he's obviously been briefed, so he started talking about pets being abandoned after Christmas and stuff, and I said about, obviously, Lucy's Law, which was my main campaign that I got the OBE for. Was a campaign that was inspired mainly by my grandma. And the reason for that is she was a Holocaust survivor. She escaped on the Kinder transport. And that's a project that Prince Charles is really, really passionate about. So he's hosted sort of lunches for Kinder transport Holocaust survivors for the last few years. And she used to go to them. So I said, look, first of all, thanks for this whole experience. And second of all, you met my grandma a few times. She sadly passed away last year, but I really wanted to use this moment to say thank you so much for making her so happy every time she met you. And you could see his eyes sort of light up because it was much more of a personal level. And he said, yes, so, you know, remember her, and it was always nice to meet her. And she was hilarious. The last time she met him, I think it was 2 years ago, she said, you look so young. Do you take Botox? Do you use Botox? And he was like, oh, no, thank you, though. So they always had a laugh together, and it was nice to sort of complete that circle in a weird way. and just use that opportunity to thank him for making her so happy all the time. Yeah.
Did she remember her experience under the Holocaust?
Yeah, of course. She was 17. Yeah.
She was 17.
Yeah, yeah. She died when she was 100 last year, so she remembered. And the story of her escape is phenomenal and very unique because she was too old to get on the Kinder transport. So she came home from her from school, and her parents had gone, and the sister had been taken away, and the front door had been bashed down. So she sort of escaped and found her way, I think, to Leipzig, where she found the train that was taking the kids, and she was too old. So she ran to a fancy dress shop in Leipzig and bought a nurse's uniform with a Red Cross on it, came back to the station and pretended to be a Red Cross nurse that was saving the children. So she was let on the train, and that's how she escaped. So she, obviously, then they went through, I think, Berlin and then Holland and then across to Harwich and then down into Liverpool Street. And by the time she arrived, she was the only one of 10,000 kids who didn't have someone waiting for her. So she was a 17-year-old German in a country... So who had fled a country that hated Jews and is now in a country that hates Germans, and we're just about to go to war in 1939. And so she was taken in, I think, by some Quakers in Edenbridge in Kent and kind of made a life from absolutely nothing. And it was her mantra, if you like, of anything's possible and never give up, that sort of was my mantra for all my campaigning. So it was nice to sort of... link that back to Prince Charles in the OBE moment, because she was such a part of my campaigning journey and still is.
Do you know, did she know what had happened to her family?
Yes, so she found out in a few years later they'd been gassed at Auschwitz.
Were they Jewish German?
Yeah. So she came from a place called Meissen, which was in East Germany, and we went back there a few times with her, and she did talks and she did school visits, and she was like... You know, she wanted to do as much as she possibly could to stop it happening again. And there's a memorial book in Meissen, and her parents' names are there with their fate that they got murdered at Auschwitz. But and then outside her parents' house, original house, there's what's called Solbersteine, which in German is stumbling stones. And they put brass plaques over the cobbles, and they write where who lived in that house. And their fate. So when people walk and they stumble, they keep getting reminded of what happened.
Gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. They're popping up all over sort of Germany. But her parents, Leo and Regina Mashitsky, were one of the first Solbersteine, and we were there at the unveiling of it.
Gosh, she sounds like a remarkable woman.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Hilarious. And she's obviously very missed. But yeah, lived to be 100, really, and then died a week later.
It's not sad, is it, when they die at 100? I mean, you miss them. My nan was
exactly.
99, bless her. She didn't quite make her 100th birthday, but I was so close to her, a bit like it sounds you are. Where with your grandmother, it was obviously awful to lose her, but it's not sad at that age.
You know, because it's at the right time. It's when people die way before their time. That's obviously a huge tragedy. So yeah, as you say, it's sad, but it's expected.
It's a wonderful heritage. But
if people want to Google her, she was featured in a Guardian article. So if you Google Guardian and then Judy Benton, you can actually read her story.
I'd love to do
that. So it's online. There's a few articles written about her.
It sounds like you've obviously been to where she was from and everything. Have you been to Auschwitz?
Not yet, no, but I do want to go. My sister's been, and it's something that I have to go. I have to go and see at some point, yeah.
I'm thinking of going to see myself, actually, with me and my mum are going to go. But it's good to sort of combine it with something... lighter-hearted when you're there, you know, because I was at the war graves not so long ago in Belgium, seeing my great-grandfather's grave, and then the next night we spent in Ghent, you know, having a really nice meal and, you know, just sort of like...
So Krakow is quite close,
yeah, isn't
it? Krakow,
which is
meant to be quite
one.
A cool
yes,
little
exactly,
city,
yeah,
town.
That's where I'm thinking of going, Krakow, yeah. Auschwitz for the day, and then you almost feel incredibly... You feel guilty, mm-hmm. but really lucky, you know, after you've visited such a place like that.
For sure.
So as well as Prince Charles, you've also recently had an encounter with our good Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and his wife, Carrie.
Yeah, I'm very proud to be responsible for sourcing a rescue dog for number 10. I remember when Obama got his dogs, and he got Portuguese water dogs that were gifted, and they were pedigree puppies. And it was so frustrating because they got so much press that I thought it would have really raised the profile of Rescue if he'd chosen Rescue. So then an opportunity came about. I campaign at quite a high level politically. So a rumour was going around Downing Street that the Prime Minister and his fiancée at the time were considering getting a dog. So I got in touch with Carrie, who I knew through campaigning. I said, before you make this decision, can we have a chat? She said, yeah, of course. She goes, come to number 10 tomorrow. I'll pick you up at 4 p.m. in the foyer and come up to the flat. This is the flat that's often talked about in the news.
The decorated flat.
The flat is massive. We think of a flat as like a tiny flat. It's like a three-story mansion inside number 11. It's so deceiving, you know, from the outside. Anyway, we had a long chat and I'm in the Prime Minister's living room. And I told her about a charity in Wales, which I'm patron of, called Friends of Animals Wales. And they only rescue and rehabilitate dogs that are the victims of the third-party puppy trade. So ex-breeding dogs and stud dogs who are going to be shot because they're infertile, or puppies with problems that aren't going to be sold by third parties that are going to be drowned. So that's all they deal with. I told Carrie, and Carrie's always rescued dogs. She said, yeah, I'd like a dog from them. So I sort of did an intro to the charity, a wonderful lady called Eileen Jones. On WhatsApp, and Eileen started sending me dogs to send to Carrie, and she was then sending dogs to Carrie for them to choose.
Sending the information, I'm assuming, not actually sending them the dogs.
No, sending the information, yeah. You know, the profiles and the pictures and stuff. Exactly. And, that would be a bit more controversial. So then I kind of let them get on with it. And then... I had the little tour of the flat. It was quite surreal, but it was fascinating. And then I left them to it. And then about 10 days later, I just arrived in Spain. And friends and I were having drinks on the beach at Malaga, at one of the beach bars, which is, Malaga's a very cool city, by the way.
It is. And
as you know.
Yes.
And and the phone rings. And the phone rang and sort of we're all like getting drunk on, I think it was just beers and red wine at that point. And so I was like, it was a number that I didn't recognise, but it was an actual English, British number. And normally I would never, ever answer a phone call that I didn't know who it was from. I just don't do it. But I thought I was a bit drunk and I thought, who could it be? So I answered it and this voice went, hello? And I was like, hello? Is that Mark? And I was like, yeah. He goes, it's Boris here. I'm with Carrie and we've decided on Dylan, right? And I'm like, this has got to be a joke. And he goes, are you on holiday? I said, yeah, I've just arrived in Spain. He goes, I'm terribly sorry to interrupt your holiday. I said, Prime Minister, you can call me whenever you like. I'm glad you've chosen Dylan. And Dylan was a 15-week-old rescue pup with an undershot jaw who would have been drowned that they chose to adopt. And, how can we make this happen? And I think they had a summit one week and busy the next. Obviously, this is the Prime Minister. And then I think 2 or 3 weeks later, I met the guys from Wales off the train at Westminster Tube Station. They obviously come in from Paddington and walked around the corner into Downing Street with little Dylan in the puppy carrier. Aww. And the world's press were just there because it had been leaked in the Mail, and I think it had been leaked that it was that day in the Telegraph that morning, and so many news channels cut to it was obviously a slow news day. I think Sky cut to it and various others, that there's this sort of new cabinet member arriving in Downing Street. So I'm carrying this little puppy and knocking on the door, you know, and of 10 Downing Street. Then we went up to the flat and little Dylan met Carrie and met Boris for the first time, and then we had like a little photo call in the garden. And one of the most overwhelming moments for me as a campaigner was I had a bag of Lucy's Law rosettes, and Lucy's Law is the law that I campaign for, which is to ban puppies sold in pet shops. And I said to the Prime Minister, I said, Boris, you know, would you mind putting a rosette on? And he was like, no, absolutely. And as a grassroots campaigner, to see the Prime Minister wearing your rosette that you fought 10 years for the campaign was unbelievably overwhelming and definitely a moment. But yeah, I'm very proud that... The profile of Rescue Pets was raised because there's now little Dylan in number 10.
Can I just take you back to getting that phone call on the beach in Malaga, slightly tipsy, and you're kind of going with it. You think, okay, this isn't a wind-up. This is the Prime Minister.
And I put him on speakerphone as well, so everyone could listen, and everyone was like, what is going on?
Everyone's like, oh, my God. God. That's so funny. What happened when you put the phone down? Did everyone just laugh their heads off?
Yeah, and apparently, I mean, I can't really remember the phone call now, but apparently we spoke for sort of 20 minutes. I remember the first bit, and I think I remember saying goodbye, but God knows what I said in between, because we were all quite drunk. But yeah, it's just shows. It's just a, you know, the Prime Minister is asking, you know, when we can do the handover and choosing which rescue
like
dog.
Like a normal person. I love it. That makes me like him a little bit more.
Oh, he's,
than
he is
did.
An animal lover. And then, you know, other people, Ricky Gervais, I work with, Brian May, who I work with, it's Rachel Riley. All these amazing people, and everyone is connected via animal welfare and compassion and kindness and empathy. So, yeah.
So it'd be Brian May and the Badgers. He's had a big badger campaign, hasn't he?
He did have a badger campaign.
And Ricky Gervais and the dog meat would be
Ricky Gervais right? And anything to do with animal welfare he supports. He's been an amazing friend and ally over the years. And he gave me the quote for the cover of my new book.
Nice.
Yeah, so which I'm just blown away by. So it just shows.
Did you work directly with them? Did you spend time with Ricky and Brian?
And just incredible people. That it's almost like they see the work that you're doing, and their own, not their only way of supporting, but the easiest way of supporting is just sort of to retweet something, or to give a quote, or to share something. And they play it down. It's like, oh, I only retweeted it. But obviously the impact that makes, not just because it reaches so many more people, but the value of the endorsement of that person is just, it's crazy. So
this is not the sort of thing you anticipate when you're doing your vet training. What sort of first set you off as the sort of celebrity, the vet to the stars, as you seem to have become?
It was, well, quite randomly. When I moved to Brighton, I set up the emergency service in Patcham, and one of the best ways of raising awareness about that was I approached the Argus, and I started writing a weekly column for
Our local newspaper.
So I wrote a pet animal-related column for free for about 3.5 years in the weekend Argus. Then I wrote for Latest for quite a bit. And then randomly, I had a locum vet come to where we were, the surgery, and they mentioned that Paul O'Grady's show needed a vet because he was moving channel. So I went for the casting, and I took my scrapbooks of all my Argus columns. And I said, I love educating people and raising awareness to do with animal welfare. And they said, okay, you're in. So I did about 5 seasons with Paul O'Grady. That made me a TV vet. I did BBC Breakfast. I did This Morning, Alan Titchmarsh, all those sort of shows. Terrifying because they're all live. But what gets you over it is the fact that you're helping so many animals. And that's more important than actually how I'm feeling. And I also learned that it's good to be nervous because you kind of want to do the best job possible. And it means you care about what you're doing. And then once you're a TV vet, obviously, you have a profile, and that's easier to connect with other people in the media with regard to campaigning, but not essential. And then I saw the case of 8 puppies coming in dying of parvovirus in 2009, and that kind of changed everything because I wanted to do something to stop puppies ever being bred in that condition again. And then 10 years later, we now have a law that all breeders are accountable, which they never have been before, by banning third-party sales, so people have to go direct. So it was nice to change the law to help prevent the suffering that I saw those puppies had to endure 10 years beforehand.
Gosh, you've travelled so much. I've got a list here due to your work as a vet, which is actually, campaigning and animal welfare, which is actually not what you expect. You know, you've really made that your passion. So in my little list of where you've been, I've got you vaccinating dogs against rabies in the Mumbai slums, rescuing dancing bears in Ukraine, saving cats and dogs in post-tsunami Thailand, rescuing dogs from dog meat farms in South Korea, neutering pets deep in the Amazon jungle, working with pit bulls in a US prison, operating on street dogs in Udaipur. Did you say Udaipur?
Udaipur
in India, as well as performing dental work on a rescued moon bear in China. Are you like a vet superhero, just sort of slinging on your backpack and heading off, or are these organised situations?
Well, I guess there's 2 points to be made. One is I love travelling, obviously. But the other thing is when you do this voluntary work with these incredible charities and organisations around the world, you're immediately immersed in, I guess you can describe it as being backstage in those places. You're not a tourist. You're not sort of booking on an open top bus. You are literally rolling up your sleeves and getting on with it with locals. And that I find fascinating because you can use your skill, i.e. being a vet, and you're immediately embraced by people that love animals, and you obviously carry on performing your skills in a different country. The inside of a dog doesn't change. So for one minute you could be in a surgery in Brighton, and the next minute you could be operating on a dog sort of on a table in a rainforest, or in the case of tsunami in a Buddhist sort of temple, because they were the only buildings that were left standing. So yeah, when I look back, there's been some incredible adventures. Obviously, I've met some unbelievable people and unbelievable animals, and it's not over yet. I just can't wait to get out there again. And now I have a profile. It's so nice to now help share stuff and raise profile from some of the most amazing charities around the world. And I'm an ambassador for quite a few of them, which is hugely... Oh, it just feels amazing to be able to help on those sort of levels.
Well, where did it start? Like, maybe let's do it chronologically. Where did you start sort of travelling off and fixing animals?
It's difficult to pinpoint an actual trip, but I think the tsunami was definitely one of the first trips, and that was, I flew out on Boxing Day. So it just happened, and I remember I was on my emergency shift, coming off my emergency shift and watching it on Sky News and thinking, I just have to be there to sort of help not just the animals, but also the humans. So I flew out, and I think I was there for about 6 weeks, helping animals, helping the humans, helping the sort of rescue recovery. And we were in Phi and Khao Lak and some fishing villages which weren't touristy, so they weren't receiving that sort of level of help. But yeah, mind-blowing and emotional, and I saw some things that obviously people should never see. And the weird thing was, it was so normalised when you're there, seeing bodies and seeing boats in trees, etc., and just the devastation that went on for miles and miles and miles, that it wasn't really affecting you. But when I came back to Brighton and I walked on the beach, that's when it hits you, because you're looking for bodies in the sea or looking for destruction, and the guilt kicks in, because you're like, you know, my life is absolutely fine compared to what I've just come back from. And then I raised a load of money with some dog shows around the country over the next year, and went back and presented them with a check, the charity I was working with. So I felt like I'd done something constructive about it. But yeah, it was a phenomenal experience to be operating for, I think, about 16 hours a day with someone holding a torch. You're in a Buddhist temple. The monks are bringing you rice and banana leaves and bottles of water, and you're treating the animals that have been affected by the tsunami, and you're going blow darting on the back of motorbikes for dogs that are lame and stuff to capture them. Yeah, it was an unbelievable time. I'll never forget it.
I didn't even think about the animals, you know. I didn't even think about that, but of course that's a huge issue,
because what happened was a lot of the animals just ran, and they went to higher ground. When they came back to the beaches where they were fed, obviously everything was gone, and all the beach bars had gone, and the people that fed them were gone. So there was a rumour that the Thai police had been ordered to shoot dogs that were seen eating corpses. That's how mental the stuff was there. So our aim was just to get the dogs all to safety and round them up, and cats, and put them in the temples and then deal with their injuries and stuff. The saddest thing I think I saw, apart from the obviously devastating human tragedy and sort of piles of bodies, you know, baking in the sun, was there was a dog on this paving stone in this wiped out fishing village. I think it was called Barnam Kem, just north of Khao Lak. And the dog obviously lived there, and he was still waiting for his owner to come back, even though it was completely flat. So there's those images. I remember also I was operating on a dog and seeing a child being buried like 20 yards away in a shallow grave. And it was like, what is going on in the world? But to be part, like all these trips, to be part of something that is creating good things, I think is what drives me, not just for animals, but for humans as well. It's all linked. And funny enough, saving the animals gave the surviving humans a focus. And that was obvious too, in that sort of absolute despair. There was something positive that the humans could contribute to almost distract them from what was going on, or to help distract them.
That must have been a life-changing trip.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. Yeah.
So how did you get to the other places, China, South Korea?
China, I'm an ambassador of a charity called Animals Asia, which hopefully some people will know about, and they rescue and rehabilitate moon bears that are exploited for their bile, sort of ancient Chinese medicine. which in brackets doesn't work. So they rescue these moon bears, which are incredible animals. Definitely Google Animals Asia. And they have these sanctuaries in Chengdu and in Vietnam. They're making amazing progress in terms of banning the actual practice. I was able to operate on a moon bear, which are bigger than humans, which was fun. And then the dog meat trade was with Humane Society International.
Hang on, back to the moon bear for a minute. I mean, how big is a moon bear?
I'm 6'3", so taller than me.
Yeah. And is it? I've always wondered this thing about vets, because you know, if you're a surgeon, human bodies are very much like each other, you know, on the inside at least, I'm assuming, because you know, operating on a cat is obviously quite different to operating on a dog or a bear. You know, this is obviously your first bear. I mean, nerves when you're cutting open the bear, or is this just what you do?
To be honest with you, the template for most mammals is very similar, and you're able to adapt. I mean, you think about a Chihuahua versus a Great Dane. You know, there's a hell of a lot of differences there, but the basics are the same, and it does sort of go across. And also you're in the presence of people who are experts in moon bears, so you're kind of being guided by them rather than sort of going in all guns blazing assuming everything's the same.
I love the fact they're expert in moon bears, but they're bringing in the vet from Brighton.
Well, I was only popping in as of they very kindly I say let me operate, but they very kindly allowed me to, you know, to do the basics, and it was just an amazing feeling to be part of the solution. And then career was Humane Society International, which is a phenomenal charity against the dog meat trade. And that was a blessing and a curse in many ways. The blessing was we freed over 100 dogs from a dog meat farm after HSI, the charity, had negotiated with the dog meat farmer, and they get them to sign a contract, and they demolish the dog meat farm, and that farmer does something else. The curse was we actually visited a dog meat farm that hadn't been negotiated yet. So we sort of saw all the dogs, but you just know they're going to be murdered and they're going to die. And you see the posts where they're going to be electrocuted and butchered. And that was absolutely heartbreaking, because as you approach the kennels, they get excited. As you get closer, they think they're going to be next, because they can all view what happens to their friends. So they start rolling backwards, trying to get behind each other. It's one of the most upsetting things I've ever seen. So hopefully, you know, they've done the negotiation, and hopefully that'll be closed down at some point. But it is a tradition that is dying out. It's a very much an older generation delicacy, and the young Koreans are kind of ashamed of it. So hopefully there's not long left till that sort of just fizzles out.
How do you convince people, you know, and should we? Do we have the right to go somewhere and convince people that something they've been doing for centuries, their tradition, is wrong? But, you know, on the flip side, we are killing and eating cows and chickens and pigs willy-nilly by the hundreds of thousands every day.
In my opinion, we have absolutely no right to tell people what to do and what to eat. The difference is the way that they're killed. Now, here, I know I'll keep going on about violence, but it's usually sort of stunning first, before animals are slaughtered. They're tortured first. So they believe, or a lot of people believe, the meat tastes better when it's been more stressed. So they boil them alive and they skin them alive. So that's kind of the difference. I guess on another level, the difference would be you're eating a pet compared to eating a farm animal. You're eating,
dogs are pets,
socialized, yeah, rather than a farm animal. But to me, a life is a life. Again, referring back to my dear friend Peter Egan, you know, when you're talking about animal rights, the right is the right to life. And I think all animals have as much right to life as we do. Interestingly, I was at a reception once in Westminster, which was against the dog meat trade. And I looked at some supply food, some don't. And there was ham sandwiches, chicken sandwiches, and what was it? I think it was tuna. And I went immediately to the organisers and said, I find it strange that you're telling another country not to eat dogs and cats, but you're serving up different animals here. I said, do you not think it's a bit, again, disingenuous? And they went, oh, do you think so? So it's amazing how people just don't get the connection. And again, I think it's just something we all should take responsibility over with so many alternatives around. We don't need to kill animals and eat them anymore. We never did.
What about the people that will say you need it for protein?
We don't. I mean, there's so many vegetarians around, so many vegans around, plant-based, whatever you want to call people that just refuse point-blank to eat animal flesh. I mean, it's even now moving to the pet market, pet food market. You know, there's a lot of vegan dogs out there, a lot of plant-based dogs. Most of the dogs in India and Thailand are vegan just because meat's so expensive and they don't need it. You know, dogs are omnivores. So it's interesting. It's changing so quickly in people's attitudes.
Now, that's interesting. As a vet, you'd say that dogs don't need meat.
Cats do. On the whole, but dogs do very well on plant-based. And you know, I've worked all over the place and seen dogs do very well on meat, and I've seen dogs do very well on vegetables. And much like us, we're all individuals and we all enjoy certain food and do well on certain food, but dogs can do well on plant-based as long as it's obviously a complete diet. And people just don't think, oh, I'll make it up myself and it'll be fine. It needs to be complete. And there's some fantastic brands now on the market, especially in the last few years, that are producing these complete diets that work, yeah.
Because you can be a crap and unhealthy eater and a vegan, can't you? You know, you have to like,
yeah,
you have to
absolutely
make,
right. Yeah, as long as it's done properly,
whatever diet you have, you have to make an
do
effort.
Do it responsibly, and it's fine.
Which, whether you're a meat eater or whatever, it means a lot of healthy vegetables and fruits. And
yeah, and I think
fibers and all of that.
You know, these days you've got to think of the impact on the planet. You know, the less meat that's consumed is, you know, it's much better for the planet. And I think pets do contribute to that. Pet food does as well. So it's just about being responsible and being the best you can be, I think.
I'm struggling with the planet because I haven't eaten meat for 22 years, so I feel that that's good. I've never owned my own car and I get public transport everywhere and walk. I did 35,000 steps the other day, just walking around Brighton, just pottering around. And it is a lot, but then I do fly, you know, and a lot of people are talking about alternatives to flying, which I'd love to do, but it's bloody expensive and I'm paying for me and two children. And then, you know, I looked into getting the train from London to Spain, to the south of Spain where my parents live, in Malaga, recently, and I got as far as Paris and then flew from Paris to Malaga because it was just going to cost us about £700 for the train and take 3 days, and that's if we didn't stop off in any hotels and eat and drink along the way. And it's just prohibitively expensive, which is such a shame. But I, you know, everyone, like, you know, I feel like mentally I'm offsetting my flights by not having a car and not eating meat.
Yeah, I think that's sensible. I think everyone should be doing what they can and just be conscious about the decisions they make. And I think over time, the more responsible decisions you make, I think that encourages more responsible behaviour. You kind of get into that routine, if you like, and you're constantly looking out for opportunities where you can be more ethical, let's say. But yeah, everyone's different and everyone's on their own path, their own journey. I don't think it's right to force anyone to do what they don't want to do, but I think it's all about empowering people with the information so they can decide, if they choose to, when and where it's appropriate to make those big decisions.
Tell me about the Amazon.
Amazon is unbelievable.
I haven't been to the Amazon.
I was backpacking around and I did a few months in Brazil. And I've been to two Amazons, actually. It's the same Amazon. I've been to the one in Brazil and the one in Peru.
They don't have a second one, do they?
The one in the Amazonian jungle in Brazil is the one to go to. Peru is sort of a smaller version.
Yeah, a pathetic little Peruvian Amazon.
No, not pathetic, can't say that.
Your pathetic Peruvian Amazon.
Right? With your little sloth, big ones.
Yeah, exactly, small trees.
It's incredible. I mean, I stayed for 2 weeks with an Amazonian Indian native family on the banks of a tributary, and absolutely, I mean, it couldn't be more in the middle of nowhere. You see pink dolphins and grey dolphins and toucans and macaws and monkeys, and it's a piranha. I mean, it is paradise. It is paradise. And then obviously it's rainforest, so it rains a lot, and you have rainbows and double rainbows, and you go on canoes, like in and out of the waterways, and especially at night, you do these little night trips and you're shining your torch and these little red dots you see, and that's the eyes of the alligators. And then they sort of go under and you can feel their backs scraping the bottom of the canoe, and you can, you know, feel your heart beating and the stars, and there's no pollution at all. So it's phenomenal. But it's interesting because I got so used to being in the Amazon, even though I was there for sort of 2-3 weeks. And then you go down the Pantanal, which is the swamplands on the Bolivian border, which is also beautiful. And then you sort of go to Iguazu, which is famously one of the most beautiful natural wonders of the world, the waterfall on the border of Argentina and Brazil. And then you slowly come around Ilha do Mel, Ilha Grande, Rio, and civilization sort of builds up along the way. So from going to the Amazon, which was just like nothing, and you're just sleeping in hammocks and have nothing, you know, in terms of electricity, obviously, to going to somewhere like Rio. And you see the sort of gradual progression as you travel hours and hours. It's such a massive country. And it was just sad to be back in civilization because I got so used to being surrounded by nature. But yeah, I definitely recommend it. And if you can, spend as much time as you can. Because when you fly into Manaus, obviously it's full of eco tours, this, and come and Jungle Lodge. And they're all, well, I wouldn't say all. A lot of them are quite close to Manaus because they facilitate people that are traveling and backpacking or rich tourists who don't want to go too far into the forest, into the rainforest. But if you can, I'd set time aside. And I think we were like 3 hours on a coach and then 2 hours on a canoe to where we were staying, which was so remote. And if anything happens to you, and it can, because there's plenty of snakes and spiders to do damage, you know, it's game over.
I was going to say, do you feel vulnerable?
Oh, massively, but that's what makes
it feel...
Is that
part of the appeal?
Yeah, that's what makes it feel quite exciting. And you do swim in the water when the piranha have fed. So there's certain times of the day where it's more safe to swim. We were in a place where the soil was... meant that the mosquito larvae couldn't reproduce. So there was no malaria and there was no mosquitoes. But you're sleeping in the jungle and you're hearing all these sounds and there's light streaming through the canopy. And, you know, you go with a guide and they can tell by the droppings on the floor which way the monkeys are going or coming, and the capuchins. I mean, for a nature lover and an animal lover, it was actually heaven. Yeah, and I'd like to go back there one day.
I'm happy with those places until night falls, you know, and then I'm like, oh, I wish I was at a five-star hotel.
But it's so loud as well when dusk falls. It's the noise of the jungle, and then also, obviously, the dawn chorus. It's kind of mind-blowing, and it does make you feel kind of insignificant. And, of course, it's about survival of the fittest with a lot of these tribes, so they'll have 20 kids because some of them will die. They'll get bitten by snakes or whatever. But the responsibility these kids have is, I mean, I remember at the time my nephews were, I think, 3 and 5, and they had these parties and presents and lived in a nice part of London. And then when I went travelling, you have a 3-year-old with a machete peeling potatoes and a 5-year-old sort of going across the river, which is infested with piranha and alligators, to get some supplies from another tribe. And so, oh my God, we have a lot to learn in this country.
Compare that to this morning when I was trying to get my kids to school and they don't even know to shut the door. I was saying to their dad on the phone, I was like, how do they not know? Like, the last person out shuts the door, and the last person to come in the house shut the door. Otherwise, we just come in the house and we're here for like half an hour to realize the door's wide open. And then you've got these kids, you know, with machetes, and
it's insane. You know, they're all given responsibilities at such a young age, which is normal. And you just think, wow, I think we have a lot to learn from these incredible indigenous tribes.
When my kids come home, I'm going to give them a machete. That's the first thing I'm going to do, is give them a machete.
Definitely do that.
And say, look, Mark
record,
said it's all right.
For the record, I'm not endorsing machetes for children. Thank you.
There's the charity, machetes for children.
Machetes for children, hashtag. Children. Yeah.
Should have one. So the Ukraine, you went to Ukraine, which is obviously in a very precarious and sad situation at the moment. But what were you doing now?
So I was working with a charity called Four Paws, who are a phenomenal charity, one of my favourites. Their head office is in Austria, but they have a UK office, and they do stuff about the illegal puppy trade, and they do stuff about bears, and they have sanctuaries over there too. So we were neutering dogs and cats. I think it was just east of Kiev, like an 8-hour drive as soon as we landed. Massive country, Ukraine. Mm. And then we were transferring a bear from a zoo to a sanctuary. So that was interesting. So, yeah, it's, I mean, what a country.
How did it go? Was it all okay?
Yeah, it was all okay. And the people are lovely. You know, it's 10 years ago. Made some really good connections over there.
Were they dancing bears? Were they sort of performing bears?
Yeah, so one of the traditions in Ukraine, I don't think it's that popular anymore, is a bear in a cage outside a restaurant and they just feed it vodka. And so they're sort of all over the place. And that's unbelievably cruel, obviously, and exploitative. But I think, again,
also it's really random.
Yeah, it's really random. And I think it's another tradition that's sort of generally dying out, because I think young people now, especially with access to social media, are just being made so aware of what's right and what's wrong when it comes to animal welfare. So, again, it's an old-fashioned tradition that we encountered and that we were able, with the charity, to do something about. Yeah, so we took the bear back to a bear sanctuary where I believe it still is quite happy, even with the war going on. I think I spoke to the charity the other day, actually, and because when the war started, the bears were still hibernating, so they didn't disturb them. But I think they're starting to wake up now because it's spring, so I'm speaking to them in the next few weeks and I'll find out some updates.
That is, again, something that you don't consider, you know, when there are big tragedies like the tsunami and the war as well, in this sense. You know, what does happen to the animals?
Yeah, and there was quite a lot of footage in Kiev Zoo. And it's amazing, you see these people who are selfless, you know, staying behind, feeding them, driving supplies to make sure the animals have them. There was a fear that if you release these animals, of course, then you've got wild animals running around the city. So what do you kill them all, or do you just make sure that they're safe and looked after, which I think the latter happened.
Somebody's got to stay behind. Like, if there's an evacuation, somebody's got to stay behind.
Some amazing stories coming out of war zones where people just do stay behind because they are so dedicated to those animals that they've always looked after. Yeah.
And you're working with stray dogs in the Mumbai slums.
India, I think, is my favourite country. I've been there twice. It was never on my list, but I had the opportunity maybe 12 years ago, to go to Mumbai. And I contacted a charity called Welfare of Stray Dogs India. This is what I do. I'll maybe go to a country and then I'll look up who the local charity is. They were incredible, Welfare of Stray Dogs India. Great campaigners as well. They stopped dogs being poisoned and killed because of the potential rabies risk, and transformed the culture to one of neutering, ear tagging, and basically not killing. So I joined them for a week in the slums. Oh my God, what a place. Again, behind the scenes, you're not a tourist visiting a slum. You are working with locals and going all around various slums of Mumbai every day. The heat was unbelievable. There's little shade. You can't really drink everything that's given to you in terms of even water, bottled water. So you inevitably
Everyone gets sick.
But it's part of it. I was blown away by the colour, the families, the fact that these people have less than nothing, and yet they're still coming out with gifts for you. And I was filming some stuff out there, and they were holding the camera and holding my phone, and just the kindness and empathy and compassion in the slums was just—it was incredible, and I'll never forget it. The other place I've been in India, or two places really, Udaipur, which you mentioned. So that's in Rajasthan. That's the home of one of the greatest charities in the world, in my opinion, called Animal Aid Unlimited. And they rescue street dogs from the streets of Udaipur and surrounding area. They also do school visits, emergency medicine in the streets, and loads of other stuff. Rescue all sorts of animals. And I spent 12 days on the sanctuary with them and did a school visit I did lots of sort of neutering and looking after the animals and emergency stuff. I just basically followed all the different aspects every day. But Udaipur, for me, I think it's the best place I've ever been in my life. It's so beautiful. There's something about India that makes it so special. And people, you're either going to like it or you're not. It's chaos. It's dangerous. It's exciting. It challenges you on every level. And that's why I love it. You know, it's sitting in the back of a tuk-tuk, just, you know, with the cows in the roads and just that madness. But it's kind of an organised madness. So I had an amazing time there and I can't wait to go back. And then I went down to Agra, which is where the Taj Mahal is, obviously. But there's also an amazing charity called Wildlife SOS. And they rescue bears as well, and also elephants. So I spent some time on their sanctuary as well. So it's just a wonderful way to see the world via animal welfare, sanctuaries, rescue shelters, meeting people associated with those kinds of activities. And, you know, there's a few more on my list that I need to sort of tick off, and definitely a few more that I need to revisit.
How can we, as travellers, make sure we visit animals responsibly. I've got a 9-year-old, almost 10-year-old, and he is obsessed with animals. He possibly wants to become a vet, although there's a lot of training, isn't there? How long is the training?
Well, it's mainly five years. In Cambridge, I think it's still six. Right. But yeah, 5-year degree.
Yeah, that's not so bad, I guess. But he's now taking me to, whenever we go to places, we're going to zoos around the world now. This is our plan. In fact, I had my most recent guest on before you was Callie Beaton, and she's a comedian, and her son trained as is now a zoologist, is a zookeeper down in Paignton. But he, as a child, made her go to all the zoos all over the world. So I'm developing a love of animals now through this experience. I was in Paris a couple of weeks ago going to the zoo. And the idea of zoos always used to make me shudder a little bit, because I think they've moved on in most places. I like to think they've moved on into conservation and, you know, wildlife care, rather than just, you know, here's a tiger in a cage. How can we as travellers make sure we're doing that responsibly? Because you mention elephants, and now people are saying, don't go for the elephant rides. Don't swim with the dolphins. What can we do? What can't we do?
It's a really, really good question. And there is, you know, the differentiation between what's a zoo, what's a sanctuary, what's conservation. I think, first of all, do your research. It's pretty obvious now online, if you just Google where you think you're going to go, whether it's a good place or not. Obviously, places like the water parks with the dolphins and the orcas in the States are no-goes. I mean, that's such cruelty. On a mind-blowing level. I'm not a massive fan of zoos, which will be unsurprising to most listeners.
Any zoos?
Well, I think sanctuary is the word that you need to aim for, because zoos...
Actually, they don't use zoo a lot of the time, do they? Like my local zoo in Spain, which we're members of because the kids love it, is the biopark, you know?
Yeah. I think you just got to do your research and kind of just get a gut feeling of what they're about. The elephant ride is really important, because elephants, in order to sort of accept a human on top of them, they are absolutely brutally punished from an early age. Their spirit is broken, and they will just accept anything that happens to them, because they know that if they don't, they're going to be prodded with a spike, or, you know, chained up with these horrible sort of ankle bracelets with spikes on as well. So their spirit is broken, and no elephant in its right mind would ever let a human near it, let alone, you know, on its back. So anywhere that offers elephant rides is definitely a red flag. But on the flip side, there are sanctuaries, and I think that is the most important word, around the world, that you keep your distance, and they're so transparent in what they do and how those animals happen to be in their care. And I think just by researching, you can often sense, you know, who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, and obviously don't give business to the bad guys. But yeah, just do your research.
But for example, you know, London Zoo, something that we go to here.
Yeah, it's a tough one, because, you know, you got to weigh up what you value as exploitation, I suppose. And I think that they are, I guess, they're as ethical as they can be, and they do present opportunities for adults and children to experience animals close up. But then on the flip side, you could even say, you know, so many modern zoos now are producing holograms or alternatives to actually having the live animals there. It's a tough one. And I think, you know, you can look after animals in the best way you possibly can. And this transcends to keeping reptiles as pets or keeping spiders as pets.
I'm about to get a snake next week.
Do you know what I mean?
My kid wants a snake.
And it's very, very difficult and questionably ethical to keep exotic pets, wild animals, if you like, as pets, you know, because all their instincts are saying, what am I doing in a house in Hove rather than in a jungle in the Amazon?
We're all thinking that, really, about ourselves sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's very, very difficult to keep animals, to tick every single box in terms of all their, not just basic needs, but all their specific needs as a species, let alone, or a breed. So, yeah, everything requires thought and research. And, if there's any part of you that thinks maybe this is a bit wrong or cruel or exploitative, then just don't do it.
Mm. But people don't know, do they? They don't know about they didn't know about the elephant rides or the, you know, it's just such a part of things. I mean, I've never taken one, but I have been to SeaWorld, you know, in Florida.
Yeah, well, I did when I was young. And also, you know, you've been to Portobanus in Marbella. I remember going as a kid, and there were people with drugged up monkeys.
Oh yeah,
for photos. We've moved on. We've moved on in so many ways, thankfully. So again, if it feels wrong, then don't engage with it. raise awareness about it, question people about it, challenge people, use social media to raise awareness. There's so many tools that we have now that we can kind of make a difference, even if it's a tiny difference or we don't even think it's making a difference. Just by sharing content and making people aware can often instigate change, like a behavioural change or maybe even legislative. But there's things that we can do if we care enough.
One of the most fascinating things I saw on your list, well, you've done some incredible things, but you spent time in the States working. Well, there were two major things you did in the mm-hmm. States, but one was something to do with animals in prison. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Charity called New Leash on Life, which is such a
see
good,
what they did there.
Such a good name. Leash being lead in American. They basically go to the shelter, the kill shelters, of which there are a few in Philadelphia and all across the States. And it's mainly pit bulls that people have either bred or bought and abandoned. And they're going to die. They're on death row. So the charity go into these shelters. They pull out the pit bulls and the dogs that are going to be killed. And they match them up with teams of two or three prisoners in the prisons. And it's one of the most beautiful concepts I think I've ever encountered, and incredibly successful. So the prisoners then work with a behaviourist, and they keep the most meticulous diaries. They get training sessions, I think it was 3 times a week. They have to write down, you know, where the animal poos and the consistency. I mean, the real minutiae detail. And the prisoners train the dogs. The dogs train the prisoners with regard to empathy, compassion, kindness. The prisoners get reduced parole if they accept the program. And also the prisoners get guaranteed work in the animal shelter when they come out. And I was lucky enough to spend some time with them. And I've obviously never been to a prison before, especially a US prison. And it was a proper one that you see on the movies.
Bit scary, right?
I think it was more fascinating than scary. And I was meeting the inmates and they were introducing me really proudly to their dogs and watching them train them and watching the difference they were making. And it's proven now with reoffending rates are reduced when these prisoners have gone through this program. So it works on so many levels. It saves animal lives, it saves human lives, and it prevents or definitely reduces reoffending. So yeah, amazing to be around that sort of project as well.
But did you meet any interesting characters?
I did.
Who stood out of the prisoners?
There was a guy that kept sort of beckoning me over, and he was about 6'8", massive guy, which was quite intimidating, and I couldn't work out why. And every time I was sort of walking around this sort of horseshoe of inmates, he just kept staring at me really weirdly and beckoning me over. And I thought, he's got beef with me. I don't know why. I don't know how. Does he hate English people? Does he hate vets? Does he hate people that are visiting for the day? What is wrong? And as I'm going round the horseshoe, I'm getting closer to him and his two prison mates with the dog. And he's just staring at me. And I was like, maybe he's going to kill me. Who knows? And I finally get to him and I'm looking up and he's like, come here. And I'm like, what? He goes, no, come closer. So I'm literally leaning into him and he grabs me softly around the back of the neck. And just basically says, your flies are undone. I mean, in American, it was, your zipper's undone, dude. And he said it so loud and with a deep, booming voice that everyone heard and they found it hilarious. So all of a sudden, this is English vet standing in the middle of this horseshoe of US hard men inmates. And he was right. My zipper was undone. So I sort of zipped it up and carried on. And it kind of broke the ice.
Oh, that's so funny.
But I went from thinking he's going to strangle me, because he could, to being sort of the butt of everyone's jokes. And I think that the story with the flies undone just, I don't know, it was just a cherry on the cake, really, for emotional feelings that day.
And it's amazing that that connection between a human and an animal, you know, I see this in real life. It's my neighbour has got a dog recently, and my 9-year-old has a lot of health problems. We don't really know what they are. They're headaches and stomach aches and lots of different health problems. When he spends time with Bobby, the downstairs doggy, as he's known, it lights him up, you know, and that's probably what they do when they're taking pets into hospitals. And
absolutely, pets as therapy.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of pets are used for kids or adults that don't speak or won't speak. And there's obviously, it unlocks something that they feel relaxed. You know, there's kids that read to dogs now. So this the power of pets and the power of animals in terms of the therapeutic qualities is now that's being exploited, which we like, because, you know, again, animals benefit and humans benefit. Rather than exploiting the actual animal, it's exploiting what they can bring to the table. And yeah, I mean, there's so many different assistance dogs charities now, therapy dog charities. Yeah, it's just wonderful to see. Yeah, we're definitely moving in the right direction with a lot of animal welfare projects. Whilst in Philadelphia, there's another charity which, again, I'm a huge, huge supporter of them and the Grace and Steve who run it, called Finding Shelter.
And showing me your T-shirt there, yeah, which you're wearing. I love it, flying the flag or literally wearing the T-shirt.
Wearing the T-shirt. And they rescue and rehabilitate ex-puppy farm breeding dogs. They call them puppy mills over there. And for anyone that doesn't know, that's sort of these large sort of commercial breeding operations that usually sell their puppies into pet shops or third-party dealers, which obviously isn't cool, because puppies need to be seen with their mum when they're born. And yeah, they rescue and rehabilitate these dogs that are a lot of the time on death's door. They've been overly bred. They've got eye problems, heart problems, skin problems. They cost an absolute fortune to fix. But Finding Shelter, and I'd recommend everyone looks them up, Finding Shelter Animal Rescue, do some amazing work. And unfortunately, in America, it's still legal to sell puppies via third parties. A lot of the puppy breeding is done in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, in Lancaster County, which is famous for the Amish. And a lot of the Amish, again, weirdly, so when I went there to accompany them on some rescues, they'll do this, they'll have a pet dog, and then they'll have a puppy mill at the back of the house. So you've got exactly the same animal, one's being looked after like royalty and one's being exploited. So they're bred to death, really. So again, it's just this weird compartmentalism that people have and this sort of selective compassion. An amazing charity. They're fighting for a law called Victoria's Law, which is to ban the sale of puppies, kittens and rabbits in pet shops. They're making some good progress.
We don't seem to have puppies and kittens in pet shops here anymore, do we?
No, that was my law that I changed.
That was your law.
Yeah,
that was your law. That was amazing.
So that's Lucy's law. That's Lucy's law. So it's illegal now to sell a puppy or a kitten via a third party, such as a pet shop.
That's really incredible work.
Yeah, and it took 10 years, and now we've got it in Wales, Scotland, soon to be Northern Ireland, and hopefully towards the end of this year, we're also banning the import of young puppies from overseas puppy farms.
So how should we buy a puppy if we want to buy a puppy?
From the breeder, which is the only... Well, there's two legal routes now where you can, let's say, buy or choose a puppy. One is to go directly to the breeder and see the puppy or kitten interacting with its mum in the place it was born. So the breeder is accountable. The other way to choose a puppy or a kitten is obviously to go to a rescue shelter, which there are many of across the country, where you can get puppies, you can get different breeds. All animals have been behaviourally assessed. And a lot of rescues now, unlike in the olden days, where it was sort of maybe aggressive animals or animals that peed everywhere, nowadays it's animals that maybe the family has run out of money, especially at the moment. Animals that have been bought in the pandemic that people just can't cope with. It was a good idea at the time. People have gone back to work or people have died. There's so many different factors now where these sort of, a lovely phrase I heard once called plug-in pets. They're just ready to be pets. A lot of them have been neutered already and treated for fleas and worms and microchipped. So they're ready to go. So my advice to anyone listening, if they're considering getting a pet, is to always, always, always consider visiting their local rescue first before they make any other decisions.
And you've got a book coming out soon.
Yeah, I've got my new book, because I've already... my Lucy's Law book came out 2 years ago, and that was about the campaign to ban commercial dealing of puppies and kittens, so banning puppies and kittens in pet shops, for example. And that was a 10-year campaign. And then I thought, I've learned so much over a decade now of campaigning, and I never was ever into politics or law or history or anything like that when I was growing up. So I learned literally from scratch as a grassroots campaigner, you know, in terms of changing behaviour, raising awareness, changing laws. And I thought, how handy would it be for anyone who cares enough about making a difference to have a book where they understand all the tools that are out there that most people may not know about, or certainly not how to use them effectively. Because if you're a grassroots campaigner, you have minimal resources, especially financial. But there's something that we can all do, and it ranges from retweeting a petition link to leading your own campaign. So I wrote it up, and I started last summer, so it's 7 months it took to write. And it comes out on June the 9th. And the title is based on a Dalai Lama quote, which is, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. So the book is called Hashtag Be More Mosquito, How to Campaign and Create Change. And it goes through, every chapter is a tool that's out there, from e-petitions to use of social media, traditional media, celebrities, select committees, all the different things that we can all do and all have access to and are largely free that can make a difference. And I really want people to use it to just help them make the changes that they want to see, because anything is possible. And if I can do it, having no knowledge of campaigning or politics or law, then literally anyone can do it.
Brilliant.
And I do recommend, obviously, people buy it, which will be nice, but buy it because they want to use it to make the world a better place. And I think we're in a society now where we blame and it's never our fault, or it's up to rich people to change stuff, or maybe there's just apathy because it's not important. But I think if we can swap that sort of negativity for positivity and constructive energy, then we all play a part in fixing and the solution, rather than everyone just moaning and being upset all the time. So I hope it helps. And I'd appreciate feedback when people have sort of read it, and hopefully they can let me know that it's helped them.
Hashtag Be More Mosquito. Love it.
Hashtag Be More Mosquito. If you want any more information about what I do and stuff, then Twitter's probably the best place.
Are you on Twitter? I mean, I follow you anyway, but...
At Mark the Vet.
Mark with a C.
And I do have a Facebook page, which is Mark the Vet as well. So I tend to post most of my stuff that I'm doing on there, especially charities, overseas organisations that I recommend, that I would totally wish people would, if they can and have the resources, to go and visit and volunteer with. It's amazing how much loving animals and how far it can take you around the world, and what a difference you can make if you care enough.
I'm going to ask you my last question now, and my last question is always about music, because I believe that music and travel very much go hand in hand. And if you have to choose one song that reminds you of a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song and what is the memory?
Wow.
You can think about it, don't worry.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I do listen to music. Favourite artist by far is Prince. But when I travel, I tend to watch comedy on my phone. And one of the most memorable times I watched comedy was, I think I was travelling from Delhi down to Agra in the middle of the night on this one of these incredible buses that have these little curtain compartments. I mean, it was, you know, the sort of bus that families are on and animals are on. It's one of those beautiful things about travelling in India. It's that chaotic thing. And I was in my little cabbie hole with my curtain closed, and I was watching the US Office. And obviously I'm a massive fan of the UK Office, but also the US Office. And it was just so surreal to be watching the US Office on this, I think it's like a 6-hour journey. It was a flat tire. First of all, I didn't even know I was on the right bus, because it was all so confusing. I'd missed another bus through traffic. And when I think back about travelling in India and those long bus journeys, that's the one comedy that springs to mind, the US Office.
Love it. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Mark. And thank you for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the podcast on whatever app you're listening to us. And we will be back very soon with more excellent guests.